In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
By now, you probably don't need anyone to tell you that local media outlets, newspapers in particular, are in trouble. We in the media have told you all about that. And if you're listening to a daily news podcast, you probably care at least a little bit about the disappearance of these publications. I hope so, anyway. The problem, though, is often framed in specifics for the industry, which is understandable since we're talking about the media covering the media, and we do like to do that. That means what you hear is about how many people will lose their jobs, who's making cuts, which newsrooms are impacted. And that matters, of course. But maybe it's not the most relevant way to communicate to you, the public, what's actually happening. We have an election coming up, you may have heard. It is a pretty important one given the current state of the world. So what happens when a media, trying like hell to do everything on a shoestring budget, has to cover a huge national campaign, but also 338 local campaigns? What kind of coverage can these outlets afford to take on? And what's the first to go when they can't? What replaces that kind of coverage? What options do voters who want to be informed have to seek out the analysis they need? And, of course, how will savvy political campaigns take advantage of this situation and take advantage of you? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. April Lindgren is a professor of journalism at Ryerson University. More importantly, she runs the Local News Research Project, which digs down into exactly this. Thanks for joining us, April.
My pleasure.
Can you first try to give me a sense, using any paper in particular, of the state of local news political coverage right now?
Well, I was doing some research recently and looking at a paper called Red Deer Advocate,
right,
serving Red Deer in Alberta, 100,000 people. And I spoke with a journalist there who retired a few years ago but was still involved in the local union. And she had some pretty interesting and sobering stories to tell me about a newsroom that back in 2012 had 24 people still in it. And today, going into the federal election coming up this fall, is now down to about 9 people who are going to be providing political coverage of the local races. And, you know, if the leader comes through town, covering that as well. And part of the story that she told me was, you know, years ago in previous elections, not in 2015, but before that, they used to do what was called a ride around. So that's when a journalist and a reporter go out and they ride around in the ridings.
Right.
And they talk to people, get a sense of what's going on, get a feel for the mood, who's doing well, who's in trouble. And that was eliminated in 2015 and isn't going to happen this time either. So you have sort of a less coverage of in depth like that. Fewer ridings because they just don't have the people to do it.
Yeah.
And also doing stories that are more probing or in depth because there's a missive from management that each reporter has to produce at least 2 stories a day and do some briefs, short snippets of stories if issues come up, maybe shoot some video. And when you've got that on your plate as a sort of a daily mandate, there's not a lot of time to produce any sort of in-depth profiles of the candidates or look at issues in more depth and find out where local people stand on those issues and explain why it matters.
So without that stuff, with reporters having no time to kind of do more than the straightforward stories, where do people get that in-depth coverage? Does it exist still?
Well, I think if you're lucky enough to live in a bigger city where there's a sort of a bigger pool of media, chances are you can get a little bit more information. Now, keep in mind, I'm talking about coverage of local candidates and the races to represent a riding.
Yeah, not the leaders.
Not the leaders' race. Because, you know, you can find out all sorts of stuff online about what, you know, Justin Trudeau is going to be doing that day or Andrew Scheer, that's going to be there. But the issue is what's happening locally and how do you hold those local candidates accountable? So if there's an incumbent, what's that incumbent done for the last 4 years that they've been in Ottawa or in the provincial capital?
Right.
So holding power accountable is a big part of what local journalists do. And also, you know, people think that, well, who cares? I mean, the local race, it's the national race that really determines what happens in a campaign and what the leaders are doing. And that's what's going to determine how the election turns out.
Certainly, that's what we talk about in the national conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's actually been some recent research that shows about 10% of all ridings are decided by people based on who the local candidates are.
Really?
So, you know, that's enough. That's the difference between a majority and a minority or between winning and losing. Those local races do matter. And to the extent that people are covering them, the coverage matters. But what happens when reporters aren't on the ground? Well, one of the things that happens is candidates start shaping their own messages and putting their own messages out. So they're using a lot of social media, direct mailings. And basically they're telling their version of reality.
Here's what I did the last 4 years.
Yeah, and aren't I great? Yeah, you can be sure they're not saying, here's what I did in the last 4 years. You might want to think about my record and, you know, whether you really want to re-elect me.
Let me break down my wins and losses here.
Yeah, no. Absolutely. So, you know, people say, well, I'm getting the information. I can, you know, go to the candidate's website. They send me emails. I can find that out. But people forget is that what journalists do is they have the time because they're paid to sort of take the time to look at how the candidate or the incumbent voted. What they said in Parliament, did they bring forward any legislation, how responsive were they to local constituents, like did they ever show up in the riding? And you're only going to get that sort of coverage if you've got a reporter who's got some time and is paid to actually ask those questions.
So why is this kind of stuff the first to go when papers have to make a call? I understand that newspapers are in trouble, and that's something I think everybody kind of knows. And that staffs are being cut, but who makes the call on what gets covered and why, if this is so critical to an election, does it go away?
Well, it's not just political news that's disappearing. I mean, this is part of a wider problem. So, for instance, I dug around for some numbers and talked to the union that represents journalists in a bunch of different newspapers across the country. And even I, who've been looking at this issue for like 5 or 6 years now, was shocked by the numbers.
Really?
So, for instance, the Ottawa Citizen in the early 90s had 190 people in their newsroom. Today they have 50. The Kingston Week Standard, you know, winner of a couple of Michener awards for public service journalism in 1990, used to have 55 people in its newsroom. Today, 8.
Wow.
And the story, the Montreal Gazette used to have 275 people. Now they have 41. So it's not just political news that's falling by the wayside. It's all sorts of news in the community. And some research has been done in the States on two aspects of this. The first is what this Penny Abernathy has called the emergence of ghost newspapers. And the idea is that it still publishes, or there's still a newscast, or there's still a TV cast, but the capacity of that newsroom to actually tell people, keep people informed about what's going on in their community is so limited that it's there, but barely.
Right.
So I think that's, so it's not just that news outlets are closing, and we know that 275 have closed since 2008. It's not just the closings. It's the sort of scaling back to the point where newsrooms are really struggling to tell political stories, but also to tell all sorts of other stories in communities.
Tell me a little bit about how you try to determine the scale of this problem and what the local news research project does.
Well, we've done a couple of projects. We're working on a couple of others, but I had this question. You know, it's a big country. Every little new community has a different media landscape, and we know that there are problems, but how do we track that? And we had a real difficulty in being able to measure it and track it. So I worked with a colleague at UBC, John Corbett, University of British Columbia, and we created this crowdsource map called the Local News Map. And the map allows people who know their own communities to go in and add information whenever a local news outlet closes or one opens, or there's a service reduction, or there's a service increase. And so we've got data now going back to 2008, and it shows that 275 local news outlets of all kinds, so we're talking newspapers, radio stations, TV stations, have closed since 2008 in about 200 different communities. Most of those closings actually have been of local community newspapers.
Yeah.
What was maybe a two-newspaper town is often now just a one-newspaper town. And people say, well, okay, who cares? You know, you still have one newspaper. But that means that's that there are fewer journalists tracking what's going on. And also, you don't have a diversity of perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I talked recently to the mayor of Collingwood, and they've got a scandal underway up there and a judicial inquiry into a situation where they sold off part of their public utility, and there were questions about how the money was used and the actual sale process. And he said, you know, I think actually if we'd had a more active, vibrant, robust local news system here, that this situation may not have developed because more questions would have been asked throughout the whole process. So that's, you know, an example, and I thought it's kind of a powerful example where even the mayor is thinking, like, there's a problem here of what happens when you don't have a really active local news environment with reporters who are keeping track of what those guys and those people in power are doing.
You kind of mentioned a minute ago that when one of the two local papers in an area closes, some people will say, who cares? And I feel, and I don't think too many people would disagree, that there's been a rise in anti-media sentiment in Canada and the United States especially. How can you fight against that? And are people reacting to the work you're doing with alarm or with the who cares attitude that you spoke of?
Well, I think you're right in that people in many cases shrug. There's a few things going on. First of all, is people are shrugging and saying, who cares, you know, the local paper's closing, because often what they have is one of these ghost newspapers that I mentioned recently.
Right.
So what they open the paper or they look at what's online and they think, well, there's nothing there.
Nothing's going on.
Yeah, there's nothing there. Nothing's happening in town. You know, there's an interesting survey in 2017 that they asked people about their local news situation. And 86% said they would still get news even if their local paper goes out of business. So they, you know, people are thinking, okay, it's still going to happen. I'll still find out what's going on. And even people who lived in a one newspaper town, 84% of them said they'd still stay informed even if that one newspaper closed. So people, I think, maybe they're getting more aware of the issue, but I think there's a lack of awareness of where news actually comes from. I think media literacy and understanding where news comes from, and it doesn't come from Facebook. It comes from news organizations that are producing news and that gets picked up and disseminated on Facebook.
Aside from obviously promoting themselves on social media and everywhere else, are politicians heading into this election cognizant of the decline of local news, and are they changing what they do because of it?
Yes, I think that's happening. I mean, first of all, nobody phones them up to interview them anymore. So that's a bit of an issue. Or in many cases, you know, I talked to a politician out in Nanaimo, and she said she was in Ottawa for the last few years. And she said that she was so concerned about and recognized the lack of capacity for journalists to cover the stories that she was involved in, that when her staff started preparing the press releases from her office, they started phoning up local politicians and local service agencies and getting comments from them and actually putting that into their press releases so that the journalists could just rewrite the press releases. In another case, I spoke with a guy who runs a think tank on rural Ontario. And he said, you know, they produce all sorts of interesting stats, one of which was some numbers showing how uneven availability of long-term care beds were depending on where you live. So one small town might have a lot of beds available and another wouldn't. So what's that about? But he said, you know, they used to, if they put out statistics like that in the past, they'd get a phone call about it from journalists or more than one in many cases. But he said, you know, that's really dried up. And now what he sees happening is, in many cases, just the actual press release itself is taken and just plopped into the newspaper with no filtering of it and no questioning of what it says by journalists and no interpretation of it. And more importantly, no work on explaining what the local situation is, you know, because their statistics would be province-wide. But, well, okay, but how's that playing out here in our community?
Right.
And that's what people are missing out on.
In 2007... TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
As we go forward and local newspapers continue to shrink or vanish, does anything take their place digitally? I know there are a ton of great national politics sites that do a ton of deep analysis, but on a local level, is there a digital future for local news?
Well, our data from the local news map shows that there's been about 100 local news outlets have started since 2008. So they're closing at about twice the rate that they're launching. But what I found surprising was that there aren't a lot of digital local news sites. I thought there would be more, and it could be that we're missing them and we don't have them on the map because, as I said, it's crowdsourced. But we're constantly on the lookout for these sorts of sites. And I think there are a number of problems with that. I mean, the advertising base is still is small, and in the same way that a newspaper can't earn a lot of money from a digital ad, a digital news site can't earn a lot of money from a digital advertisement. And it's challenging. Like it's really challenging to run a news organization these days, and to make enough people aware of it, and to produce the kind of content that people are going to make it into a go-to site, and then to convince advertisers, local advertisers, that they should advertise on your site because you're reaching a core audience. I wish I could say yes. Obviously, digital news is jumping in, and these digital news sites are going to work, and it's terrific. But we're not seeing that reflected in the research numbers, at least at this point.
Whether people agree or disagree with it, there was a significant amount of money promised by the federal government for news organizations in the last budget. Is that going to help? Where's that money going? What could it do?
Well, the federal government's kind of outlined what it is going to do. It was $595 million over 5 years. The biggest portion of it is going to be used to subsidize salaries for journalists. And at the moment, there's a lot of controversy about that. And I have questions myself, because what I'd like to see is more journalists working in newsrooms, not maintaining ghost newspaper staffing levels.
Right.
And I don't get the sense that this is going to cause a flurry of hiring of additional journalists to provide more comprehensive coverage of communities. So I think that's a problem.
Would local newspapers qualify for this funding?
Yeah, now? In fact, one of the criticisms of it is that it's very print-oriented, and that it doesn't, the rules around it aren't so open to supporting more innovative digital sites, for instance.
Right.
To your earlier point about, you know, is digital going to step up to fill in the gaps? That's the main use that the money's going to be put to. There's also the government's changing the rules to allow more charitable support for news organizations of all sorts. But they have to be nonprofits. So that means if, a nonprofit is in your community, you could send them $20 and you could get a tax receipt. Or it makes it easier for a big foundation to come in and give some money to the news organization, say a digital startup, to try and help it get on its feet and solve some problems.
How many of these local newspapers are nonprofits?
Well, that's the issue.
I mean, I know they don't make profits, but
yeah, they are no profits, but they're not necessarily nonprofits. And you know, it's not just newspapers. This will apply to all sorts of news organizations, I hope. But that's part of the problem, is we don't have this culture of nonprofits now. So, you know, that's $595 million over 5 years. But newspaper revenues alone have been cut in half. So in 2008, they were about $5 billion. And in 2017, they were $2.5 billion.
Yeah.
So that's $2.5 billion of revenue that used to support all these local news organizations, newspapers in this case, has vanished. And $595 million spread over 5 years, it's $100 and some million a year. So clearly isn't going to solve that problem, nor is this fledgling charitable initiative. But I think there's not going to be a silver bullet to solve this problem. I think it's going to have to be a range of different initiatives. I hope that the nonprofit model will emerge as something more viable for Canadian news organizations. I hope that's going to happen.
So what else makes you optimistic then? Because thus far our chat has not made me optimistic. What other measures are out there?
The best scenario I can imagine is that if some of the most struggling newspapers, perhaps communities rallying and local buyers to either take them over and run them as nonprofits, or convert them to digital news, digital sites where they still have a relationship with their audiences. And you end up with owners who are committed to producing journalism as a public service. Because that's really where we are right now in this dilemma is news is a public service. I mean, we need it for a whole bunch of reasons. There's, you don't realize it, but, you know, if you see a story in the local media about a local employer who's doing a bunch of hiring, that can have a big impact on your life. Or say there's going to be changes in the school board spending on recreation programs or fewer teachers. I mean, all of those have real impacts on people's lives, and you need to know about it in advance so that you can participate in those debates in your community. But if that sort of information is unavailable, then you've got a real problem in trying to play a role and participate and be part of your local democratic society in a town, a city, or a municipality.
In the changed landscape that we have right now, we're heading into a really important election. Who benefits, if anyone, in the federal parties right now from a lack of local coverage? Does this play into anyone's hand particularly? Is there a place where the impact is going to be more severely felt?
Well, I think the benefits are going to be to the parties that run smart social media campaigns and control their message. So Alex Marland, a prof at Memorial, has interviewed over the last year or so about 125 federal, provincial, and provincial politicians and political staffers. And he said one of the things, at the same time as local media is weakening, what's happening is politicians and the parties are becoming more disciplined about their messages. Mm. So what everybody's terrified about, if you're a candidate or you're running a campaign or you're at party headquarters, is that some local candidate is going to make some remark and it's going to go viral and it's going to look bad and the party's going to look bad and the leader's going to look bad for letting that person run and the candidate's going to look bad. So what they're doing increasingly is enforcing a really, really, really disciplined message on everybody. So if you're talking to a local candidate in rural BC and one in rural Newfoundland from the same party, chances are you're going to hear exactly the same lines from those politicians. And they're also going to be tweeting out very similar materials on their Twitter account, posting the same sorts of disciplined messages on their Facebook sites. And he speculates and says that one of the consequences and one of its concerns is that it opens the door to more populist appeals from politicians who are seen to be plain speakers and who don't seem to be, you know, just pushing these canned party messages. And the danger is, of course, that you're falling for, you know, the guy who says, or the female politician who says, "I am a politician for the people. Vote for me," and they don't really have a policy, but, you know, I'm going to get those creepy elites that are running the show now.
Right, and nobody will lose their job.
And those journalists, and nobody's going to lose their jobs, and everything's going to be great. And they don't seem to be reading from a script when they say that. And so there's political appeal in to at least part of the population. And don't forget, you don't need to shift a lot of voters in Canada to win.
So on the one hand, and I just want to pick on that just for a second before we close, because on the one hand, you have those populist politicians who can appear as plain-spoken, and that's to their advantage when nobody's questioning them. On the other side, there is Justin Trudeau and his team. I think everybody would say he rose to power in 2015, probably in large part due to his excellent use of social media.
Yeah, and it's not just, you know, the opposition parties. It's, in fact, I think the government is extremely disciplined in telling its MPs and, or, you know, provincially, its members of provincial parliament what to do. So, you know, this isn't just a phenomenon, this canned message at every level, in every forum, in every situation, amongst every candidate. It's not just something that's happening in opposition parties.
Yeah.
In fact, it's probably more happening more amongst governments because they have the capacity. They tend to have more money if they're elected and more capacity to impose that kind of discipline on their candidates. And also, you know, their candidates or their existing MPs, they want to, you know, be rewarded. They want cabinet posts or whatever it is that's being dangled in front of them. So they are, you know, towing the line in terms of parroting the party line.
Last question. What would you recommend to somebody in a non-Toronto, non-Vancouver, non-Montreal, smaller market that's seeing their papers dwindle and their local news going away? Where would they get that local news, or what can they do to save it?
subscribe and advertise would be sort of two starting points.
Nobody ever says advertise. They all say subscribe to your local newspaper for $5 a month. Nobody mentions advertising.
But if you're a local business person and you run a business, advertise on your local radio station, your local TV station, your local newspaper.
Your local podcast.
Your local podcast, your local digital site. Yeah, absolutely. And if you have any spare cash running in hand, go ahead and start a news outlet.
Really?
I mean, the barriers to entry are basically non-existent now. If you have a laptop and a microphone, you can launch a website. Now, the trick is to make sure you actually cover news, because it's not enough to just sit there and spout opinion. Journalism is a precise thing. Journalism is timely. It's verified. It's produced by independently, so you don't have, there's no conflict of interest between the person who's doing the story or the news outlet that's running the story and the sources. And it's transparent, so people understand who owns it, who runs it, what it's doing, and the quality of the stories. So, you know, it's not enough to just start an opinion blog or an opinion podcast.
Mm-hmm.
News means actually going out and verifying information, doing it in a timely way, producing it independently, and giving people information that can help them navigate daily life that they can trust. And that trust factor and building that trust factor is probably actually one of the biggest challenges that anybody getting started will face. Well, that and the financial side, because the business models have been broken and we haven't figured out a way to fix it yet.
Well, thank you for doing all of those things for us today.
You're most welcome.
April Lindgren is the head of the Local News Research Project. And that was The Big Story. You can find more from us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can hit us up on social media at TheBigStoryFPN. Find our brother and sister shows at FrequencyPodcastNetwork.com. And find everything we do everywhere you get podcasts. Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, it doesn't matter. We are there. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.